Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. Each night, we'll bring you the best and the brightest authors and experts with something called solutions, the topics you want to hear, and the people who know to bring them to you. So let's do it together. Let's get to the heart of the issues that face us every day, right here, right now on Dresser After Dark, coast to coast and around the world on the BBS Radio Network.
You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say, don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance.
Stefania Luchetti with us, and she's been practicing corporate law for more than 10 years now, working for international law firms and at the House Legal Department of multinational corporations in Europe and in Asia, with a specific focus on telecom, IT, media, and internet industries. She's qualified as an attorney in three jurisdictions. Stefania is the author of The Principles of Relevance, the Essential Strategies to Navigate Through the Information Age, and she's the founder of the Women's Leadership Project. Stefania, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be talking to you.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, we really have trouble in communication when we're looking at something global. You know, how is it as an attorney, as looking at the world through your eyes, and especially with the information age the way it is, the overload, that mass amount of communication we get, how do you cut through this? How do you understand and bond, connect with people from different parts of the world and still hold some semblance of order?
It's a really good question, because the issue there is that we all need this connection to the internet right now, because that's what we're used to, and this is what also allows us to live in a flatter world. You know, I'm in Hong Kong, right, and I'm talking to you, and you're in the U.S., and this wouldn't be possible if it weren't for the internet, if it weren't for the amazing tools of communication that we've developed along the years. But what happens is that we get overloaded by it, and we really get stressed out, all of us. And I'm talking especially for corporate executives. They're on Blackberries all the time. They're typing emails all the time. And also other people, you know, looking at the internet, messages, emails that arrive. I don't know, how many emails do you receive every day as an average?
ask Radio Susie, who produces the show. You're talking, it's unbelievable. She gets bombarded. Oh, absolutely.
Now,
one of the things that you say, and I think is critically important, it's working smarter, not harder, but for the most part, the shorter work week, more vacations, step away from it and then come back to it. I imagine that's one of the greatest things that you can do if you get overloaded.
Yes, exactly. That's exactly the point. Because what happens to your brain is that when it gets overloaded, it stops thinking, because it just wants to get away from the overload. It just wants to move out of it. So it makes decisions way too quickly, or it doesn't make decisions at all, which is not good. If you think about it, in the last financial crisis that we've had, we always wonder whether it was due to information overload rather than anything else. And what you can do to make things more effective for yourself, to really get your brain working again, because the brain really works. The hard work that the brain works does, it happens when it has time to think, when it has space to put information together and come up with creative solutions. So it's really important to take time away from technology, even though it seems counterintuitive, because you think taking time away will be less productive. It's actually not true, because that's the only way that you can allow your brain to start thinking again and to come up with solutions and to solve creative problems and to really push things forward on a project, on a matter, on anything that you're working on. So what I advise people to do is to take at least 2 hours break from technology every day, and it means 2 serious breaks. Don't look at emails first thing. Just give your brain some time to process the day, to make to create a purpose for the day, to decide what it's going to be focused on that day.
You know, when it really comes down
in the morning, especially, this is really important.
Yeah. Your brain is very much like a computer. And if you overload that computer, the computer is going to slow down on you. It's going to take time before anything can happen with it.
Exactly.
And that's the same thing that you're saying.
Yes, so I totally agree with your metaphor. It's exactly it. It slows down because it's bogged down by data. And as I said earlier, it just ends up making decisions too quickly. A computer shuts down. The brain does the same thing. Well, the brain doesn't shut down, but what it does, it just runs away. It runs away from the information, and it runs away by either not making a decision or making a decision that is too quick.
No, absolutely. There's no question about that. You know, one of the things also that we're looking at in this age of technology, where did you say you were calling in from?
Hong Kong.
Okay, right. Okay, so we are, you know, you're there, I'm in the States, and it's as if we're touching each other. We could be so close. I mean, think about, you know, 10, 15, 20, 25 years ago, if you wanted somebody to have something, you had to send it snail mail. It took a while to get there. Now it's instantaneous. And I think with that overload, and going back to the analogy of the brain being like a computer, information in, information out, you have to treat yourself like you treat that computer. If you begin to understand the dynamic and the way the computer works, then you get a feel of how you work and what to do. I think taking a break, getting away from it for an hour or two, a little shorter work week is one of the most important bits of advice anybody could have.
Yes, exactly. Well, I've started working 4 days some time ago because I'm a writer and I really need that process things, and I find that day a week when I take some time for myself, I'm actually.
Seth, I think somehow we got lost. Okay, it sounded like water. We are across the pond. Okay, we're talking about this. We'll get her back with us any moment now. Stefania Lucchetti with us. You know, she's the author of The Principles of Relevance, The Essential Strategy to Navigate Through this Information Age. And that in and of itself is critical because what she was saying. Oh, good, Stefania. We lost you for a minute. That's the information age when you get overloaded and it stops.
Oh, yes. Well, that happens sometimes. What we were saying earlier that really resonated, and I think I want to explore a little bit more, is how we should compare how our brain functions with how a computer functions. And here there's one thing that I always tell my clients is that we have to shift perspective. Is that we tend to like to be effective.
Seth, I think we lost her again. And that's okay. That's all right. But hopefully we'll get her back because she's calling from Hong Kong. And they're about 13 hours ahead of us. And when we really come down to it, it's true. Your brain is very much like a computer. It's information in, information out. You overload your computer, the computer is going to shut down. It's going to get slow. It can't deal with the volume of information that it gets. And at the same time, go out and get stressed. Go get hit from five or six different areas all at one time, trying to juggle everything, trying to create some kind of balance. And the same exact thing is going to happen to you. So how do you treat your computer when it gets overloaded like that? You shut it down. You shut it down. And that's really what we're saying. Shut down for a little while. Walk away from it. Go to sleep for a couple hours or take a day off. And then you come back and your mind is absolutely with it. Every one of us has gone through that no matter what kind of field that you're in, whether you're pumping gas at a gas station or you're a rocket scientist. It's all the same thing. There's only so much. Ah, wonderful. Stefania, what I basically was saying that your mind is very much like the computer. You overload the computer, you have to shut it down. You overload your mind and your brain, and you've got to shut it down for a while. You've got to walk away from it and come back to it. So they're very much likened to each other.
Yes, exactly. And what do you do usually with a computer when it's overloaded? You buy an external hard disk and you download some data into the external hard disk so that your computer is not slow anymore. Well, if you think about it, it's the same thing with the internet. You can actually imagine and start viewing the internet as a sort of outsourced memory for you. So you don't have to keep everything in your brain. You don't have to follow up everything. It's impossible because everything is available. What you can do is take some time off and then go back to it whenever you need something. And that's the shift in perspective that we all need to make now in this information era, is about not following up on everything, but knowing that we have an outsourced memory, it's there, and we can access it whenever we need it.
Okay, very important when you said shift in perspective. It's that shift in thinking, and you can do the exact same thing if you think about it just a little bit differently. Everything can happen the same way, but the outcome is completely different if you take those couple of steps to stay focused and on target with what you want to accomplish. And I think that's what happens with most of us. You get on the internet, and if you're depending upon it for work, for study, for whatever the case may be, that you begin to lose focus of the end goal. And you do that, and then you get into trouble.
Yes, exactly.
Now, in the book, in and of itself, the principle's relevance. Okay, I pick it up and I read it page by page, cover to cover. What's my, Stefania, what's my takeaway? What do I get from that book that I didn't have before I read it?
Well, the first takeaway is that it is up to each individual to take responsibility for how they deal with information in the information. There's been a lot of hype, I think, last year about how the internet is making us stupid, how the internet is, you know, turning our brain into mash, basically. I don't agree with that. My perspective, and it is what you will take away from the book, is that the internet is a tool. Is a tool that is very powerful, and it is really up to the individual's responsibility to learn how to use it so that it's a tool of empowerment rather than a form of destruction.
Now, by the way, when you talk about a form of destruction, and you've said it, let me paraphrase it in this way, that it's there for a purpose and a reason, and if you misuse it, overuse it, then it's your responsibility for the stress that you put on yourself because the outcome didn't come out the way you wanted to. So it's really up to us to understand the dynamic. If we understand the dynamic, then we can work with it properly.
Exactly. Very well said. The second takeaway is that you can learn to process information much more quickly by taking time off from that information, as we said earlier. Taking time off from information allows your brain to make connections. And by making connections, you can actually make decisions that are relevant, that are deep, that are purposeful, and that taking into account a much wider, a much larger pool of information rather than decisions right away on just one set of information because it's urgent, because it's there in front of you. So the second takeaway is taking time off allows us to process information more quickly and in a more relevant way.
Okay, so in essence, we just need a break, and we need to be able to look at it and for what it is. And I wonder really, Stefania, if people really truly understand this magic that we have in front of us. You know, we get so much information about how to use it, and it keeps changing so drastically and increasing in its value every day. It's very hard to keep up, and a person could get actually lost in it. And you're right. Instead of doing the job it's supposed to do, it can end up damaging you.
Yes, exactly. And in the end, it also allows you to make, which is the third point, the third takeaway of the book, is that by learning how to do this, by learning how to use information in a way that's empowering and that taking time off from that information when it's necessary, you can reap huge benefits not only in your work by becoming more productive, more effective, but also in your personal life and in all the things that you really want to do, because this will really make you more creative. It will make you able to turn to make your ideas happen, which is actually the topic of my second book. Because by learning how to take time off, get ideas, then process the information quickly and then use the internet as a tool to support the research that you need to do, the connections that you need to make, then you become a very powerful person. You will become really very skilled at making things happen for yourself.
Okay, so realistically what we are dealing with is just know your subject, understand how you respond to it. There are different ways to respond, and don't put all of the responsibility for your outcome on the internet. Do it for yourself, so you really need to know the proper way to handle it. By the way, now we're starting to run out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at?
Yes, it is www.theprincipleofrelevance.com.
Wonderful. And we can buy the book there?
Yes, you can buy it from there. There are links to Amazon and Barnes & Noble. The book's available there. And there are also free tips on how to manage information, how to manage your time, and lots of other interesting things.
Wonderful. Stefania Lucchetti, thank you so much for joining us. I've appreciated your time. And have fun in Hong Kong.
Thank you. Thank you. It was really great to talk to you.
Okay, good night.
And a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. That's all. That's all. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'd be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Matt Whitfield with us, features editor, Yahoo Entertainment. Matt, welcome back. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
And can you believe I talk for a living, right? Blah, blah, blah. By the way, all right, I saw some of what went on, and I thought Macchio is back in action.
Macchio is definitely back in action. He tied for the lead this week. He and his partner Karina really kicked it up a notch. I expected that and mentioned that on the show last week. They did a great job with the quick step, and now he's back in the mix.
He sure is. And how about Kendra?
I'm not really surprised Kendra left. You know, we knew that she was one of the few people that had her head on the chopping block. She did have a better score overall than Kirstie Alley, but more of Kirstie's fans bothered to pick up the phone, and Kendra was sent packing. But she left on a high note. She had a great week for her, and I think she did herself, you know, some favors by appearing on the show, and I think it will definitely help her career going forward.
I agree, and I think I really thought Kirstie should have gone, but I agree with you. The fans kept her on. And Kendra, I think, made such remarkable progress when she started.
She definitely did. But the weird thing with Kirstie's scores, though, this week, they were all over the map when it came to her jive. I mean, she had a 6, a 7, an 8, and a 9. So it was very inconsistent from the judges. So, you know, I'm glad that she has another week to see if she can really wow all of them.
Yeah, consistency is definitely the issue. I think she's tiring out. That's my opinion.
I think she's tiring out as well. I also have a feeling that she she didn't think that maybe the competition was going to be as stiff as it is, and she could probably coast more towards the finals, but that's obviously not the case when you have such other great dancers out there competing and really going for the title. So Kirstie's really going to have to step it up in the next few weeks. I mentioned last week that she and Ralph really needed to elevate their games, and Ralph certainly put Kirstie to shame this week.
He did. I mean, I'm predicting, I could be wrong here, but I'm predicting that Kirstie will go next week. I mean, if she stays one more week, it's totally because of the fans. That's my opinion. There's five of them left, and so then we're getting into the, after next week, we're getting into the semifinals.
I know. I mean, my only guarantee for the finals right now is Hines, because he has been the front runner essentially from week two or week three. But the crazy thing is, if Ralph, Romeo, Chelsea, or Kirstie has, you know, a bad week next week or the week after that even, they're not going to make that final cut. So at this point, Hines is in, and I would guess that Ralph and Chelsea would be joining him in the finale, and that Kirstie and Romeo are going to be the next two to go. But I'm only saying that because Romeo had a weak week this past week, but I think that he really is capable of delivering major fireworks, and it will be interesting to see who squeaks out that third spot in the finale.
It sure will be. I was expecting much. I had high expectations for Romeo and doing the samba. I mean, I would think that would be very natural for him. I was
exactly, but he only scored a 30. He had a mix of sevens and eights, and you know, for the past like 3 or 4 weeks, he has been killing it. And so it was a real letdown for me, because I thought he was positioning himself to say, "Look, I belong in this competition. I belong in the fight till the very end." And he really let a lot of people down this week. So if he does not pick up his game next week, Kirstie could even knock him off next week. It's very possible.
I mean, you really don't know. I mean, just the fact that Chelsea was in jeopardy, that was outrageous.
Well, here's the thing. It's not all about the judges' scores. Kirstie has a ton of fans, and she's incredibly entertaining. Put all of the dancing skills aside. She's entertaining. She's the biggest star left in the competition, and people are picking up the phone because they want to see more of her craziness.
Well, you're right. I look at it totally by I take that part out, the fan part, and I shouldn't take that out. Because
you and I both love Chelsea. I mean, you finally got me on the Chelsea bandwagon.
Yes.
It took you some time, but I finally got on that bandwagon. But at the end of the day, little kids know her from her, you know, TV programs that I believe are on the Disney Channel. And then nobody else knows who she is except for people who are watching Dancing with the Stars.
Well, I would agree with you on that. By the way, not to divert a little bit, but we'll stay on Chelsea. I thought her tango was, or Paso Doble actually is what you did. I'm trying to remember, it's a tango. I thought it was excellent. And
it was pretty good. I thought it was a little over dramatic, and I guess I wasn't really feeling the costumes, and I felt like it was a little robotic. So this week was not my favorite from her, but I definitely thought that she was one of the standouts when it came to the cha-cha-cha.
Well, you know, going back to the tango for me, it is a little robotic. That's the tango. You know, and I think what was difficult for her was mechanically she pulled it off, but I think emotionally that was difficult. And I remember when they were showing her practicing with Mark Ballas's mother, she was awesome. And she kept saying,
"Oh, she was awesome. I wanted her to dance I wanted her to be out there." But, you know, we talked about this with Michael, you know, for the past few weeks, and it's about connecting to the music and really showing your emotions out on that dance floor. And yes, technically she was great, but the music and the costume, I think, prevented her from really connecting with the audience this week. She still got a great score. I mean, she landed a 34, but I just want more from her. I want her less serious and more jovial. But again, she doesn't get to pick the dances each week. She, you know, has to take what they give her. But next week she's doing a tango and a salsa. So I'm really having high hopes for her.
I am too. And I'm talking about tango. I want to bring Hines back into this too, because I felt, I mean, he did a great job. But I also felt he was lacking in some of the tango movements, which to me are very key. I didn't see him positioning his head. I don't know. I'm very technical about that stuff.
But you and I are on the exact same page. do not get me wrong, Hines is so much better than I ever expected, and I still think that he deserves to be in the competition, but I am baffled by the high scores that he keeps getting each week.
I mean,
he got
too.
A 10 for that tango, and I would have given him an 8. Now, you know, the judges were kind of all over the board with him as well, but he still ended up tied for the lead with Ralph, and they both had a 36, but that tango was just very lackluster for me.
Well, I thought it was too. It was, and it, what didn't Bruno give him the 10? I'm trying to remember.
Bruno gave
Bruno
him the 10,
it.
But Len
Shame
gave him
Bruno.
An 8. So again, you see a discrepancy. I mean, it doesn't sound like it's that big of a difference when it's an 8 and a 10, but when we're getting down to the nitty gritty here, it's kind of surprising to see that the judges have that much of a difference of opinion, and I just don't think it was worth a 10.
Well, I just happen to agree with you, and I think that what was the name again of the judge? Oh, Donnie, was that it?
Oh, the guest Donnie judge? Burns was the special guest judge this week, which I thought he was completely bizarre and did not bring anything to the table. It just crowded the judge's table, and he didn't really seem to get it, and I did not appreciate his appearance on the show.
And he messed up the scoring, too. I mean, he
messed up the scoring. He threw off the judges. He threw off the host. It was just totally bizarre, and they should never bring him back.
I agree. I'm glad they didn't bring him back. Like, yes, well, I guess there was nothing really to bring back because it was a results show yesterday. But I thought that was a poor choice myself. And at least they accommodated him. I noticed the table was longer. Details.
Well, I'm curious to know, who do you think is going to make it into that final three? Do you think that I'm crazy for saying Hines is a lock?
No, I think Hines will be in. I think Hines, Chelsea, and Ralph. That's what I think.
Yep. Okay, so you and I are on the same page there. It's just it really depends if Romeo can knock us out of the park in the next few weeks and if he can sneak in and grab that final third spot.
Right. And once again, you don't know. And doing two dances is, oh boy, that is tough.
Tough. Plus they have these group I mean, it's a lot of work goes into this show, a lot more than people think. And, you know, next week they already have all the styles set up for each of the contestants. It's going to be very interesting. I'm still, for some bizarre reason, rooting for Kirsty. I know she probably is not the best dancer and probably shouldn't
dance. I like her too. Yeah.
But I don't know what it is. I mean, I like her. I like her pairing with Max. I think that they're fun. I mean, we've seen photos of them. They've been out partying this week. They went to the Prince concert together, and they just seem like it was a good pairing from the get-go, and I would like to see them get another week.
I you know what? I would too. I mean, I was being very technical when I on my opinions, but I'm with you, and she's so entertaining, and I loved watching her jive, and yeah, she was really into it, but you know, there's a point where she didn't really care, which is actually a good thing. It's hard to go out there and everybody says, oh, just have a good time, but that's hard to do when you're being judged, and then on top of it, you know, millions of people are watching and it's live TV. I can't imagine.
Yeah, and think about all of the other celebrities and past contestants that are sitting in the crowd. I mean, it seems these days, after so many seasons, I mean, we're in our 12th season right now, that half of that crowd is made up of past performers. And that's another major, you know, stress factor on all of these current contestants. So my whole thing is this. If Kirsty pulls off a decent job next week, she has an Argentinian tango and a salsa. And if she does decent with those, I think that she is definitely capable of knocking off either Romeo or Chelsea just because she's having more fans pick up the phone and vote for her.
I mean, I can
I know that breaks your heart. It breaks your heart for me to suggest that Chelsea could go next week, but
I don't think she has
the same kind of fan base.
I you're right. But I have to tell you, last night when I was watching and there was a chance that she wouldn't make it. Part of me was saying, I was being a sore loser, you see. I was saying, that's it. I'm done with this. I'm not watching this anymore. This is ridiculous. But she stayed in.
Well, you are the ballroom expert, and I'm the reality TV expert. So I think combined,
isn't that a great
match?
I love it.
Yeah, we should have our own show. We should have our own TV show.
I think we should. I think it would be great. What do you think, Michael Ray? I'm getting Michael back.
I think you guys should do radio.
Well, I think you should join us.
No, you guys do so well together. I'm lost. I'm an amateur when it comes to ballroom dancing.
Oh, you are. No, you've you've come a long way. And a long time ago, a secret here, a long time ago, Michael Ray actually taught some ballroom dancing.
No, that was an accident. I mean, I'm telling you, I was in Florida. I was in Florida. It had to be late 60s, right? It was only 3 years old at the time.
Yeah, right.
I'm in a bar with some friends of mine, and it was one of those places where they taught dancing at night, et cetera. And I was having a drink, and I buddied up with a couple people there. And one of the guys happened to be an instructor, and I didn't think anything of it. So he was trying to talk a woman into ballroom dancing, and I jumped off the bar stool, and I sold it to her. I was just playing. I had no idea what I was doing.
But he's so good at that.
And the guy, the owner walked up, and he said, you want a job? I said, doing what? He said, teaching dancing. And I fell off. I said, you got to be kidding me. He said, no, we'll teach you what to do. We know what you want. So I spent, I don't know how long, learning and teaching cha-cha merengue and all the rest of it. But that was 100 years ago.
Are you telling me you took a paycheck without even knowing what you were doing?
Yes. But they didn't know.
I am completely impressed.
But I can still do a mean cha-cha or merengue. But the key
a little
is,
bit of salsa. I've
a
watched
little, a little
him.
Salsa, yeah. But it was a learning process. And they didn't care whether I learned to dance or not. They wanted me to get memberships.
It's all about the sales.
It's all about, it was interesting. It's fascinating. I'd tell you some other stuff, but I'd never do it on the radio. But yeah, a little eclectic, man, as I've been a little of everything in my life. The other key is when we watch this, is this going to be strong enough to keep everybody? Is this going to be a program that's going to be on for the next few years also?
100%. I mean, this season, as we said many months ago, right when they announced the cast, not a spectacular cast, but it still is drawing in major viewers. It's the number two TV show. Idol is the only show that has more viewers, and Dancing with the Stars is going to be around for at least 3 more years, so we'll at least have 6 more seasons, would be my guess. It's a juggernaut for ABC. It makes a ton of money, and at this point, stars are clamoring to get on the show because it boosts their careers. So people would pay to be on the show. So we're going to see it for a long, long time.
Okay, and I enjoy the stars coming in. I think one of the attractions is like Ralph Macchio. The last time I saw him, he was a Karate Kid type. So you love seeing those people. Kirstie Alley, she's always fun. And who did I really love? What was her name? She's probably 90 and a half years old now, and I think that kicks the
Cloris Leachman.
No, it wasn't Cloris. It was.
Oh, I love Cloris.
Yeah, no,
Leachman.
she was wonderful. It wasn't Cloris. It was Betty White.
Betty White. She wasn't on.
Not
it.
Betty White.
Oh, Florence Henderson.
No, it was, no. It was. If I'll think of it, 4 o'clock in the morning, I'll call you guys.
Yeah, give me a call if you think of it.
Yeah. Don't call me.
Don't call me. I'll call you. Yeah, it was. Who was?
Yeah, you
it?
Always do.
I don't think it was Cloris. I can't remember who it was. But the point of contention is that it kickstarts, I think, and you said it, a lot of their careers, even if they're older, all of a sudden people see them again and it opens them up to a tremendous amount of things. Because I think whoever gets let go goes on the Jimmy Kimmel Show and those kind of shows,
yeah.
And the exposure is unbelievable.
Oh, there's no doubt about it. And when they announce these casts, I mean, it is more exciting to me to see the cast announcement than it is, you know, a random week 6 where they're out there just, you know, doing a waltz or something like that. But the excitement now that builds around those cast announcements is just, it's crazy. And I look forward to it every single season. And hopefully come fall when they announce the next cast, we'll have a few, you know, cool names, some unexpected names, and hopefully some, you know, vintage 80s stars like Ralph Macchio and Jennifer Grey.
Oh, by the way, what happened? Did she take advantage of that at all? Did she get anywhere with that? I haven't seen or heard from her since.
You know, I keep looking at her resume on all these different websites, and I'm really not seeing that there's a lot of things going on for Jennifer Grey. I know that she was completely injured by the time the season ended last go-round, but I still think that she's popping up in the audience quite often this season, and I still think that we're going to see Jennifer Grey back on TV or possibly even the big screen in the coming year.
I hope so. She's very talented, very talented. Matt, website we can find. Wait a minute. Before we do this, the woman I'm thinking of is probably way up in her 80s right now, and I think she was in that program where there was 5 or 6 women living together.
Oh. Oh. Yeah. Oh. Oh. Oh.
Ah.
Oh.
Ooh.
With Beatrice Arthur?
No, but it was with Beatrice Arthur. That was the program she was in, and she was on Dancing with the Stars. Hysterical. Oh, well.
Well, nobody from Golden Girls was on, and nobody was on from Maude, as far as I know.
Well, it was Golden Girls. I thought it was. All right. Mm-mm. Maybe I'm having one of those senior moments.
I think you're hallucinating.
Okay. Well, I think that the campaign is out there for Betty White to get on the show, but I don't know that's going to happen. Yeah.
No, I don't think she can make it through the first night.
I don't know about that.
Okay. All right, guys, we're just about out of time. Matt, a website we can find you at.
You can find me across all of Yahoo's entertainment sites and on Twitter at Life on the M List.
Wonderful. And if you get calls at 4 o'clock in the morning, we remembered.
I'm going to turn off my phone.
I would if I were you.
Okay. Good night. Hey, thanks for being here. See
you
next
week.
Bye, guys.
Bye-bye.
There are so many fabulous faraway places to see, such as Mexico, Sweden, Hawaii, Japan, and Capri. There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases. Pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there? There are so many fabulous faraway places to see. Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris, and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you are listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris, and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon.
Lisa DeJardin with us is a correspondent for CNN Radio, who also reports for CNN.com and CNN Television, employing survival strategies, listen to the words, in the U.S. Capitol. She's covered extensive financial issues, including the collapse of 2008 and the Wall Street Reform Bill passed in 2010. She's the author of Zombie Economics, A Guide to Personal Finance, How to Slay Your Bills, Decapitate Debt, and Fight the Apocalypse. I can say that word, for financial doom. Hey, Lisa, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, I probably did not pronounce your name properly. Say it once for me.
Yeah, no, you're there. Desjardins.
Oh, I got it. Okay, great. Oh,
yeah. Good.
Let me ask you this. What brought you into the world of economics? What was it that triggered you to say, this is what I want, this is what I want to take a look at, and this is what's going to fill me up?
Wow, that goes back to college. It's one of those things where I was always good at math, but I hated it. I didn't understand how it might affect the world or why math was important. It just seemed theoretical. And then when I hit my first economics class, it was like a light bulb. I said, oh, this is really important. This is really important math that matters in people's lives. And I've loved economics since.
You know, when we look at economics, and even economics down to the point of paying the bills, the average person on the street, like anything else, there's a dynamic, there's a process to it. Mm-hmm. And most people don't understand the process. Where did you get how to do that roadmap to get to where people need to be?
To be honest, a lot of it was from, some of it was from our own experience. A lot of it is from my journalistic experience covering personal finance. Right after I went to William & Mary, I got my economics degree, and then I spent some time overseas, came back, and I got my master's in journalism, which really you only have to do if you have no journalistic experience, which I didn't. So I went and got the master's, and I focused on personal finance in my master's degree, and then did some personal finance reporting. So from that came the beginning seeds of this book. But, you know, Rick, my co-author, and I, both of us, as any good journalist, we've both been unemployed at different points, and we've both had to deal with financial disasters in our lives. And every piece of advice in this book is something either one of us or both of us have tried. And I'm happy to say I'm within hopefully a month or two of paying down my credit card bills because of essentially the techniques in the book. They're very straight on. Know how much you have, know how much you're spending, figure out where you can cut back without really hurting your life. And once you look at it straight on, which is what we do in the book, you can really conquer your finances.
One of the things that the tips, we'll call it, that I think is absolutely brilliant, we draw to us people who are like us. You know, if you've got relationship problems, you draw people who have relationship problems, and everybody tells their problems to each other. And the minute that you get out of it, getting something good, they don't like you anymore because there's nothing in common. One of the tips is how to distance yourself from the financially irresponsible people in your life. And I think it's the same. You're around the same kind of people, and that's what you do. And if you want to stay in contact with them, you have to be like them.
That's right. And yeah, chapter 7, and this is where the zombie metaphor comes in. And, you know, I think your listeners can pick up, this is a serious book, but we use the zombie metaphor to make it relevant and make it a little less dry than your typical personal finance book. But we call that chapter Shooting Dad in the Head, because it's hard. It's hard to tackle your friends who may be going out to bars every night when you know none of you can afford it. It's hard to have that conversation and say, listen, buddy, I'm trying to get my finances under control. I can't afford the extra appetizer. I can't afford this expensive place, or I can't go shopping with you right now. I can't afford it. And getting out of it's not just getting yourself out of your bad habits, but thinking about the people who are around you. You're exactly right. We know that that peer pressure is a very real thing. Even how we dress, how we talk, and most certainly in how we spend money and how we deal with our personal finance. So we have this chapter where we put a lot of kind of almost a checklist so that you can think about the people around you and think about, yeah, are they causing me financial problems? You can go through the questions, answer it for yourself. And then if you figure out that there is someone that is actually hurting you financially, we have advice for that awkward conversation, for different ways you can deal with it. Of course, it depends on every situation, but these are the first steps to trying to make it better.
Oh, by the way, I think that the advice and the A word, I think that's critical. You take kids, you know, they graduate from school. No one said that they learn how to live, how to financially live, you know, with the student loans, et cetera. I know somebody right now that got a student loan, I don't know, 15, 18 years ago for $1,500. And she didn't pay it. And it is now $17,000 that they're after her to pay. Now, I think that's a little too much interest, and those are actual numbers when she told me about it. But these are the things that we have to run into. Not understanding the financial dynamic that occurs within the different industries. And kids who are in college, they get out of school, and all of a sudden they're in the world, and they've got to have that dress, they've got to have that car, they've got to have whatever it is. And the next thing you know, they have to move home because they can't afford themselves anymore.
Right. And this, again, the zombie metaphor, debt is a zombie that sometimes you don't see sneaking up on you. It seems like a good thing at the moment to buy that dress, to get the car, you know, maybe get a laptop because you really need it. But the truth is, in the long term, if you can't afford those things, the stress of trying to keep them and the extra cost of paying the credit card bill for them, that it's going to cost you the opportunity of getting many more things. You know, like your friend, think of what she could have done with that $17,000 if she had just dealt with her debt off the top.
Absolutely.
She has lost basically a new car because she didn't pay for her debt off the top. And we have a lot of advice in here for college grads. It happens to be a good timing because this is a great gift for college graduates. we tell them a lot about credit cards. Now, that's advice for everyone, but it's something particularly that college grads don't have great skill at. Just like you say, we don't teach kids in college how to deal with debt. One of our tips that I like to point out is we tell everyone, use your credit card just for emergencies. Really try and be disciplined about that. And one way to help yourself, take the credit card, put it in a mug, fill it with water, and put that in the freezer. And just make it that much harder to get to your credit card.
There was somebody some years ago, I did an interview, and she had the absolute perfect perfect answer for how to get yourself out of financial difficulty, but it only works one time. She was living in the Midwest, and she went to New York. She got a job in one of the high-end corporations, and she had to buy, she's 20 years old, she had to buy new clothes, this, that. And the next thing you know, she is so far in debt, it's unbelievable, $50,000, $60,000, $70,000. And for her, that was a lot of money at the time. What she did, Lisa, was she put an ad on the internet that said, please help me, whatever. You know, she got about $20,000, $25,000 people donated. She paid off the debt and never got into it again.
Wow.
That's a one-time shot.
That's creative. You've got to be creative with a lot of these things. Yeah, you can't depend on that. But, wow, kudos to her for getting that done.
Again, she could never do it again, but it was the one-time shot. Now, let me ask you this. I picked the book. Right. By the way, I have the book in my hands. And cover to cover, page by page, what's my takeaway? What's that one overarching theme that I can walk with that I know that if I have this behind me, I can take a breath when I get up in the mornings?
There's two things, really. The theme of the book is no one is coming to save you. No one else is going to save you and your finances. And the positive side of that is you can save yourself. You really can make the rest of your life much better, the entirety of the rest of your life much better, by taking simple steps one at a time. And we lay those out in the book. And in between these steps, we also have what turned out to be a really good fictional story. So, you know, it's not all hardcore drill sergeant advice. You know, we have breaks from that as well. But we try to make it clear that personal finance shouldn't be just a chore. You know, of course, it's not going to be the most fun thing you do, but you should think of it as being your own kind of survival hero, that you really should understand that you are conquering a deadly force in your life. And you should have that kind of almost adrenaline about it, you know, almost a little bit of excitement that you're doing something sort of heroic. So that's the takeaway here, is that no one is coming to save you, but you can actually triumph. You can step by step become kind of your own financial superhero, you know, and we show you how.
What I think is interesting is one sentence that you have inside of the press release. It's, to survive, you must fight using every weapon and skill that you possess. And I think the biggest problem with people today, they're not aware of what they possess, because it's in every one of us anyway. We're the ones responsible. In the end result, we spend it, we have to pay it back, or we suffer the consequence. But there's so many people that I have interviewed over the years, which I think it's great that you have a way of looking at something, a perspective that most people don't see. It's looking over my shoulder, pointing out to me what I don't see about what's in front of me that I haven't had the experience to see, and bringing that invisible up to the table so you can lay it out. I cannot fix a problem unless I know what the problem is.
That's right, exactly. And a lot of times we don't realize the resources we have. For example, do you have an extra room in your house that you could rent out? Do you have a way that maybe you could get a roommate for a little while? Yeah, you know, those are things that folks who haven't had roommates for years don't think about. You don't think about all the resources and abilities that you have. You don't think about the couple of hours you might have on a Saturday that will get you the part-time job, that will bring in the money that you need for whatever luxury item you want. You know, so instead of putting on your credit card, maybe you work 3 extra hours a week somewhere. I know that's not fun, but what that does is it makes you think, is this item worth it? Is it really worth me working these extra hours? If it is, great. Go try and find that part-time job. If it's not, then maybe you don't need that item after all.
I think the other thing that happens, too, is when somebody gets way over the head, they start, you know, the phone calls start, and there's bill collectors, et cetera, and they're not really nice about the way that they collect. And, you know, there's laws against it, but most people are frightened to death, and they scare people into doing certain things, which really isn't fair. But look at the other side of your life. If you're going to get in this, you're going to face the consequence. If you don't want to do the 3 or 4 hour a week job or the, whatever the case may be that you've recommended, then you got to face those people that are after you. And I think in and of itself can be one major thing, a loss of dignity.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and that has very real physical effects, we know. I mean, that loss of dignity is something people feel. We probably all felt it at one time or another in your gut. And you kind of, you can wear it on your shoulders sometimes. For some people, it leads to headaches. Some people, it leads to perhaps later in life, if this is you live under this stress for years and years, could lead to a heart condition, you know, if you are under this chronic financial stress. We talk in the book about physical health and about well-being. And the point of the book is to try and free you from all this financial load that ends up on top of so many of us. To try and just get you away from that burden. And we have a lot of tips for, we talk about, you should have a great life. You should have a fun life. You should have as crazy of a life as you want. But you don't have to necessarily spend money, and you certainly don't have to get yourself deep in debt to do that. And in fact, getting yourself deep in debt usually is going to drain away all of the great stuff you're doing in your life, you know, all the craziness. It's not worth it. We talk a lot about that. I think you're dead on.
And also, too, that mass amount of information that we get from the media today, most of it is going to scare most people. So it doesn't mean don't listen to radio and television and read newspapers or the internet. But what it does mean is filter it. Don't take it all to heart.
Right.
Because, you know, if it bleeds, it leads, and death, dying, and destruction happens to sell. So if we can stay away from that and filter through and realize that things are not as bad as everybody says that they are, and there's still money out there, even though the jobless rate is, what, maybe 9% or so now, stayed there with an average. That's also 91% of people who are still working, too. They don't talk about that. So the key is that we live in a country that you can recapture, and it is cyclical.
Yeah, and, you know, that's kind of the point of the book. I think you're exactly right, that it seems like, you know, the personal finance, all the bills arriving on your door, all the issues you've got, it almost is as if you can't begin to handle it. Just like the news is this bombardment of negative news. You know, we got some positive news in the last few days with the death of Osama bin Laden. Sure. Great news for the country. But for the most part, you're right. We see negative news after negative news, and it overwhelms us, just like your bills, your financial problems. Where do you start? You can become overwhelmed, become depressed, and then dig yourself further into a hole. And what the book does is try to completely just obliterate that notion and say, yeah, step by step, you can decide what you want to do. Just like you're saying, you can filter the news. You decide what you think about things, and you decide how to run your finances. No matter how bad things are, this book will get you in a better position.
You see, the book should be seniors in high school should have the book. You know, because when you come down
to it. Perfect. Yeah, exactly.
Where did you learn? When did you learn? I asked that rhetorically. What would have happened if you would know, if you could anticipate ahead what you were going to run into? And a lot of things would not have happened to you or anybody else or to me or anybody that if you'd known ahead of time. Then if you did do it, you had the choice to do it. Most people don't even think about options and choices. This is what I want. This is what I do. And nobody taught me what the consequence was if I didn't do it.
Right. Nobody realizes how much they stand to lose from making bad short-term decisions, from, you know, impulse buys. You know, I'm not saying never, ever have an impulse buy. I'm just saying people are too much into the habit of it right now, and no one understands how much they lose in the long run, how many other purchases they could have made, how many other things they could have done in their life if they hadn't wasted money for, you know, a few days of some enjoyment that was just temporary. And people were not, we don't think about that. We don't think about our future selves and how we're really hurting our chances for happiness later, you know, and we're not really getting too much out of it. These kind of short-term feel good fixes, you know, this idea, oh, I deserve to buy this. It's a dangerous one. I think a lot of people in this country deserve a lot of things that they may not ever have. The question is not, do I deserve this? But is this going to really make my life better? You know, I got to really think about this.
Now, Lisa, there's another thing to take a look at, too. It's called definitions. When you're, I don't know how old you are. I'm not going to ask. But when you were...
Oh, you're old. Yeah, I'm 39.
Okay, all right. Then let's do it this way. When you were 12, 13, 14 years old, you had a definition of money. Then when you were 20, 25, you had another definition of money. And now you're 39 okay. years old, and you have another definition of money.
Right.
And
right.
at 39 years old, you do not look at money like the 12-year-old did. And I really believe a lot of this is creating definitions. If you've got the right definitions, then you can live your life. If you don't have the right definition, and if you don't know what a thing is, you could be, and that's what the book is about, you could be in major trouble.
Yeah, it is so true. It is about who is controlling what. If you don't define, as you say, money, if you don't define the important things in your life, they're going to define you. This sort of, and that's the whole zombie concept here, is that if you don't figure out how to take on these things in your life, they will just surround you and they will take over. You know, and you'll have no control. And as we know, when you don't have any control, that leads to a lot of stress. It leads to a lot of other problems, in addition to the financial ones. And this book is about defining what's important, and even down to a basic level. We have people sit down in the book, fill out one of the very first things they do. Fill out this worksheet. It's simple, but kind of profound on how much you're really making. And we do it so that it applies to anyone from waitresses who are making tips to, you know, if you've got whatever white-collar job, it's salaried employees. We have you look at exactly how much money's coming in. And then we have people figure out how much money they really have to spend each month or before each paycheck. And then after we do the income side, we have folks sit down and look at where they're spending their money. You know, you can be as detailed as you want about it in this book. We have a detailed worksheet, or you can be general. But the idea is really define your money, not anyone else's, but exactly what your situation is. So you can get a hold of it and make it better.
Now, by the way, one other thing, we're starting to run out of time now, but very important. It's called... You define yourself. Don't let your money define yourself.
Right.
You said define yourself.
Right.
It's true. Think about the people around you. If you're broke and always needing something from someone, look at how they think about you. So it's the control. You let it define you, or you define it. And I think that's really something
right.
to walk away with. If you have the power, you can do that. Okay, Lisa, let me ask you.
We define our happiness too much. That's right.
Oh, yeah. By the way, you have a website we can find you at.
We do. It is simple, zombieeconomics.com.
Okay, well, can we buy the book
That's
there?
It. Yeah, you can buy the book. We have links there. You can also go to amazon.com. The book, we're really happy that it's a paperback book, because we don't want people who need financial help spending a lot of money on our book. It's actually really good buy right now on Amazon. So you can go to amazon.com, but it's also at Barnes & Noble.
Hey, Lisa, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate your time.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Take care. Good night.
Okay, you too. Good night.
I can only give you love that lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call. And the only heart I own for you and you alone. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall. And a loving's burning light will warm the winter night. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. Da da da.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Looking up at the control room angel. I wonder if the guest is here. And Susan Marshall is back with us, and she is an author. She's a speaker. She's the president of Executive Advisor LLC, independent consulting firm founded 1997. She's also the author of How to Grow a Backbone, 10 Strategies for Gaining Power and Influence at Work. Susan Marshall, hey, welcome back.
Hi, Michael Ray.
Now, think of this. I'm 90 years old, which I'm close to it. I'm 90 years old, and I look at...
You age well, my friend.
Back,
age well, my friend.
I look back at life, and I say, I could have, I would have, I should have. What do you do? And what happens when you're not 90, and you're 20 or 30 or 40, and you're saying, I wish I could do this?
I wish.
I say, yeah.
Yeah, you know, exactly. It's so funny. Speaking of backbone, the three elements, competence, confidence, and risk-taking. And the phenom that I'm seeing right now is really very, very interesting to me. Confidence is wobbly. And, you know, we could talk all night about the reasons why that is. But there's all of this wishing going on. You know what? Maybe it's not new, but I'm hearing more of it as I'm out talking to people and working with folks. And, you know, I wish I could lose weight. Yeah, don't we all? I wish I could get promoted. Lots of people. I wish I could find a job. But then I have to look at myself, and I've been guilty of wishing. I'm writing a new book, the first of the Backbone Guide series for women, of beauty and substance, a backbone guide for women. And I've
can
been boring myself to tears.
Can I peek at it? Oh, you are?
Yeah.
You're boring yourself.
Well, for the last several weeks, I'm writing and writing and writing. And I'll sit back and I'll look at it and I'll say, ugh, really? I don't care. Why is anybody else going to care? So I've found myself saying this, I wish I could finish this book. And so I started thinking, okay, you know what? When we wish, and I'm going to link it to confidence, when we wish and we don't really know what to do, or we don't take steps, or we don't do anything aside from wish, we start saying, if only, you know, I wish I could lose weight. If only I had the right genes. G-E-N-E-S, not the kind of things we wear. you know, if only I had more willpower, if only I could stick to something, the wish plus if only equals not only non-action, but really we start nicking away at our confidence.
Yeah, but Susan, that protects you. Now you don't have to do it. I'm going to gain 150 pounds, and if I gain 150 pounds, I won't go out there and get rejected. Or maybe if they do accept me, I've got nothing that will cause me to be able to justify that I'm right about how I feel about who I am, what I am, why I am. I
think that's exactly right. And yet, you know better than anybody that most people will not take the time to recognize.
No.
That they will
no,
simply wish
stuff.
And then oh gosh and then if only and if only and if only and actually the gentleman that I was talking to who said, you know, I wish I could get promoted, it was followed by, you know, if only I had a better boss, if only I had more self-confidence. And actually when we continued to talk about it, so there's that wish and if only. And the more he thought about it and the more he, you know, lined up his if-onlys, you could just kind of see him slumping lower and lower into his chair. And he was starting then to beat himself up. I'm such, you know, what's wrong with me? I'm such, well, as we started talking about it, he grew up in a family with six other kids, so big family. He was the fourth of seven, and he was told to not be conceited. And he was told to be humble, and he was told to be, you know, a good, gracious man, which is all well and good. But he then, in order for him to let his boss know the quality of his work would make him feel as though he was being conceited. Once we identified that, it was like, you know, bop yourself on the forehead and go, oh, really? Geez. Well, now we have something to work on. Now
but,
we
you know,
can talk about all of those times that...
It's the definite. There's a little bit of a time delay, so if we fall on each other, that's what it is. The word conceited also, you know, and we don't do that. We don't look at the family and say, "What does conceited mean?" You take it for granted that conceited is stay in the background, don't show anybody how good you can be about anything, which is garbage. But at the same time, if you get that definition and you run your life on that definition, you got a problem.
Well, yes. And it will hold you in a place of discontent for reasons that you won't really ever be able to articulate unless you actually sit down and do the work with somebody. But, you know, this whole wish factor, when we can take a wish, understand the barrier, and then turn it into an intention, it is hugely confidence building. And yet, we think, I wish, and we just, it becomes an apathy, and we become lethargic, and then we start looking at the world and deciding that we're probably as good as we're going to get. We should be grateful for where we are. We should not really put ourselves out to make anything better, because the whole world is aligned against us, and there are so many people who would never, ever say those words, but who behave that way day after day after day. And so it's interesting. I was at a state budget presentation today, listening to Mike Hibbs, who's the secretary of the Department of Administration, and he was talking about the things that need to change, and he was talking about the pushback that he gets in some places, not all, and saying that the lack of confidence people have, not only in government, but in themselves to make a better life, to get to a place where we can solve problems, is really, it's disappointing, as he said. But after a while, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Sure.
And as I was thinking about...
It comes down to this. It's the old joke about you walk into the doctor's office and you put your arm in and say, "Doctor, it hurts when I do that." And the doctor looks at you and says, "Don't do that." And it's the same thing with anything else. You know, what am I going to do? I wish that. Well, don't stop. Don't wish. Just go do it.
Stop wishing. Well, but you know, no, I want to correct myself. I don't want to say stop wishing, because when we wish, it's the generation, it's the seed of hope.
Yeah. Yes.
Unless we wish and look around and ask all of the if-only questions and decide falsely that our wish will never come true. You know, yes, being realistic about, you know, it hurts when I do that. Well, don't do that. And I want to just interject something that we work with quite a bit. Actually, it's called Beckhard's Change Formula. Have you and I talked about this before?
No.
It's a formula that says change will happen when the combination of dissatisfaction plus vision plus first steps is greater than inertia. And it's germane to this conversation because most people can, when pressed, describe and articulate their dissatisfaction. They may not have all of the reasons lined up, but they can generally do a pretty good job of saying, "I'm dissatisfied with this situation." Having a vision for what could be is far more difficult. And I think this is where the wishing gets stuck. I wish I could lose weight. Well, I don't really have a vision of me losing weight because I've not lost it. And so they'll point to someone else, they'll point to a TV ad, and I think you've said it brilliantly, a diet commercial, and say, "That's what I want. I want to be slim. I want to be healthy. But if it isn't part of my identity, I'll get to the if-onlys. The vision for me isn't clear." So a lot of people get stuck there. But let's assume that I am dissatisfied and I can articulate pretty clearly. I can draw a picture. I can color it in. I can tell you, show you what my vision for me is. Then I might get stuck because I don't know where to start. And so, you know, I'll put on my shoes and I'll walk to the front door and I'll decide it's too cold and I'll come back and, you know, I'll pop it open a can of Coke or whatever it is. So the combination of the dissatisfaction, the vision, and the first steps has to be greater than inertia.
Yeah.
And we all know what inertia is about.
You got to be knocked on your posterior enough to say, okay, I'm done. I want to change this. You know, very interesting also that we live our life, and I cannot say the word definition enough. You have a certain definition about what someone means. And most of what you're dealing with here is nothing more than a mindset. And if I'm not going to get a job because I don't want people to think I'm conceited, then I've got what I want. And there's the key. You've got exactly what you want. If you don't like it, go do something else. But when it comes down to it, whatever the dynamic was, whatever pushed you into being and feeling and acting the way you are now, how you are, and you could be in the pits, is what you want, because otherwise you wouldn't be there.
Yes, and that's a very, very difficult ownership, right? The personal responsibility, the personal ownership piece that most people, if they don't, I want to say they struggle with it because they don't understand that they are where they want to be. They've made the choices. They're living with something about a situation they grouse about works for them. I have a friend who's constantly unhappy, and she's always talking about what's wrong. And I've said to her many, many times, Rhonda, you are stubbornly unhappy. And she gets very upset with me, but something about that grousing works for her. She gets attention. She gets
Wait. That's it. That's how she gets her attention.
Yes.
That's it. That's the way she's learned. She's not even aware of it.
Well, that's exactly my point here. And when we can tell people you have exactly what you want, and then they get all indignant, they get very upset, and they tell me I'm crazy and that I don't understand and all those kind of things. And so I always say, I don't understand. Help me understand why this makes you so unhappy, but why you continue to stay here, why you continue to choose this. It's bad habit. Okay, well, then let's work on a different habit. But it takes energy. It takes that intention piece. And, you know, back to my own self-confession, I wish I could finish writing this book. I could not get past my own, you know, the whole writer's block thing, right?
Sure.
I couldn't articulate what I wanted to say. Well, what I recognized after documenting my behavior, and I was doing all kinds of avoidance behavior. Oh, my goodness, the Internet's great for hours, right, on any given day. Dog's got to go for a walk. Geez, you know, wash needs to be done, whatever.
I said, I use the closet. A hide in the closet for hours. No. you said, dogs need to walk. I hide in the closet. It's okay.
Oh, you know what? And that brought to mind a very vivid picture, and it scared me. I'm glad you said, no, that's not true.
No,
but what
not.
I recognized with my own wishing was that it was a wish. Well, I had somewhere in my mind that unless I wrote just the most spectacular book telling women how they could be stunningly beautiful and fantastically successful, it wasn't worth writing. The pressure I was putting on me was absurd. And what I recognized was that pressure of, you know, writing this, everybody was going to love it and nobody would ever hate it and would just, you know, get the Nobel Peace Prize or something like that. I don't know, whatever silly the motivation was. But it was robbing the joy that I feel in writing and sharing what I've learned.
Let me give you one thing that happens, and I'm not going to ask you this. I wouldn't do this to you on the air. But the comment that you made, and this is what stops a lot of people, don't answer this question. Are you stunningly beautiful and wonderful? And unless you think you are, when you start to write about these things, all your stuff comes up and it blocks because then all of a sudden you're writing about you, not just necessarily you, everybody. That's the key. If you can say I'm stunningly beautiful and I'm wonderful, then you can write about it. And one other thing that brought up this thing about I wish I could lose weight, I was talking to somebody who's a weight loss professional within the last week, and it was very interesting because what she said to me was that I had mentioned that somebody I know did the gastric bypass and lost 80, 90 pounds, right? And she said, you know, that there are a tremendous amount of women who get the bypass and they commit suicide. And there was a woman that my sister knew lost 140 pounds, thought she would go out dating and do all this stuff. She got depressed. It's not just that end result. You know, be careful what you wish for. You might get it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that, the work, that you know, my frame here is confidence, because it applies to all of us, and there's a fine line sometimes between the conversations that I have and the conversations that my clients would have with, you know, therapists.
Sure.
And I always am very, very clear and very direct up front. I am not a therapist. If some of these issues are deeper and more personal to you, I certainly can refer you to people. But even everyday people who are generally well-adjusted and happy have exactly some of these same kinds of questions. We all do. And when we can recognize that something is being tapped in us, and actually I love what your question you posed to me, do I think I'm, you know, stunningly beautiful and wonderful and all of that? What I dug up was, who am I? Who do I think I am? You know whose voice that was? My mother's.
Yeah. I got
Susie, it. Susie, who do you think you are? And it was fascinating to me to wrestle, to struggle, and what I learned from that and what I love with all of my clients when we get to the aha moments is we have to wrestle with those if we are going to get past them.
Sure.
And that's hard work, and it's scary work, and people get frightened, and then they go back to the, well, if only.
Yeah.
You know, Susan, if only I was as strong as you are. If only
you know
I
what?
Had so much blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, you know, I lucked out. My mom was my hero.
Oh, neat.
No,
well,
I'm
my
sorry.
Mom is too now.
Yeah, now she is.
No, I grew upset. Up.
I'm going to talk to you now. Oh, by the way, yeah. Speaking about growing up, I moved to Fairbanks, Alaska. I was, what, in my early 40s at the time. And I'm at 40 below zero. My mother would call, and or I'd call her, and she'd say, don't forget to put a jacket on. 40 below zero outside. Now, see, this was
it.
A great lesson for me. I could do one of two things. I could say, sure. Or I could let her know how immature I was by trying to prove I was an adult to let her know that I knew how to wear a jacket at 40 below. See, when my mom and I really got together was when I allowed her to be my mother. I was always her baby boy. And that's the way it was going to be. We'd be in a restaurant and she'd slip money to me under the table. And it was okay.
Yeah,
and the point
great.
Is, so I allowed her to be mom and I allowed me to be her son, and the relationship was just phenomenal. Not that we ever had a bad one, but the point of contention is I still hear her voice today.
And, you know, I love what you said, the money under the table, and that was okay. What a gift of generosity on your part to be good with that, to accept that and to appreciate that, really.
It's called
maturity. What a great moment of realization as we come up to Mother's Day, right?
Yeah, but
our moms really genuinely care about who we become as people. Well, they did once upon a time. Editorial comment, we're not going there. But we as their kids.
It's called maturity.
I
think I might have said this. I don't know if I did or not, but I was real careful about it. There was, I did a communications workshop in Los Angeles some years back. And there was somebody in that workshop that knew me since I was a little baby, all right, forever. And we were the poor relations, you know, as I was growing up. And that's the way it was. And nothing could change anything, and that's how it was. And I remember this person was in that workshop, and she was learning. And she was learning, and she was writing, and was turning things around, and was changing things in her life. And I walked out, and I looked up at the sky, and I smiled. I said, that one's for you, Mom.
I love it.
Yeah,
oh,
and it was cool.
Wonderful. You know, there's one more aspect of this kind of wishing, turning wishes into intention to build confidence that I want to just touch on briefly, because I think it's critical as people think about, okay, I have this wish and I am going to work to make it into an intention so that I can make some progress and I can build my confidence. The element of time is absolutely essential for people to understand and to learn. We live in a microwave society. If I can't answer your question in 2.2 nanoseconds, I'm dumb. If I can't get results by tomorrow morning when I take my diet pill before I go to sleep tonight, it's not going to work. And so we have to help people understand that if you will trust the vision, you know, going back to Beckhart's change formula, if you will trust where you're trying to get to and every day do some small thing, keep track of your progress, you will over time get to where you want to go, but you've got to keep at it You've got to not try to hit a home run, right? You've got to try to get on base, whatever analogies we want to use. So important in the world today.
You have to do what's going
to
work.
We do not give ourselves enough time to learn, to grow, to achieve the things that we really believe deep down in our beings are possible, if only.
And by the way, when you say take it a little at a time, another way to say that is put it in the realm of reality for you. Put it where you can grasp it, you can touch this, and you can move through it. Otherwise, you're never going to get it, and you're right back where you started from. There was somebody who had trouble making decisions years ago, and I talked to this person, and I said, okay, here's what you want to do. When you get out of bed in the morning, decide whether you're going to get on the left or the right side of the bed. Is it your right or your left foot that's going to hit? When you do you hear it? And all day long, and pretty soon it became habit, repetition of action, and this person all of a sudden now knows how to make decisions. Start out baby steps.
And so, yes, and what you did with that person is you made their decision-making obvious, part A, and part B is you helped them build their confidence in that realm of possibility.
And by the way, I didn't do anything. Do you hear that? Well, it wasn't. Mm-hmm. I didn't do anything. Just say, here it is. If you want it, do it. If you don't, I love you anyway.
Yes. And actually, I was talking about this time element earlier last week with one of the leaders in the charter school system we're working with in Texas. And she had been very, very impatient, and she was the kind of person that if I started on Monday and by Tuesday at midnight, it hasn't worked, I'm done, I'm a failure, it's never going to work, la, la, la. What she has learned to do is to calm down, to quiet down, to do things, you know, trusting that day after day after day in time, over time. She will have some success. And she said something that I thought was just wonderful that I wanted to share. She said, you know what? I have learned to give it my best, then give it a rest. And I thought, what a beautiful way to think about starting out, you know, with your intention in mind as you get up in the morning and you start going about your day. I'm going to give this my best. And then when the day is done, to say, you know what? I did what I could. Now I'm going to give it a rest. I think it's
you know, there's another
way
thing to add to that. There's another which was mine years ago. I don't care what I love you, but I don't care what you think, because if I do, I'm going to live my life based on what you think is right or wrong. And if that's not me, I've got a problem with that.
And that's the
hardest thing that people can do: distance themselves from what other people think. Let them think it. It's not your life, and it has nothing to do with you. It's nothing more than a projection in the first place.
Right. My expression for that, which I've used in my own mind for probably 40 years now, is don't like it, don't look.
You're not that old.
And yet, no, of course not. And yet we live in a world, and you know, based on the work that you do, my goodness, your profession, we are other-driven. And it's beaten into my mother, who do you think you are, right? You be politically correct, show up, groom well, be polite, mind your manners, be respectful, all of those kinds of things. Yes, and when we internalize those things and show up as a human being of wonderful capacity and tremendous contribution, we have internalized all that stuff. Now, if somebody looks at us and, you know, wants to make a remark, don't like it, don't look. But
absolutely.
It takes a lot of work and substantial amounts of time to get that grounding and to intentionally build your confidence so that you can go in the world and make the contribution you want to make, not what somebody else defines you as.
I don't know if I said this to you before, but I think one of the greatest things that I ever heard was basically this. Or if you want to set out to be who you want to be, you project yourself ahead 15, 20 years at a dinner party that's being held in your honor, and you write down what you want people to say about you. Now you got 15 or 20 years to become that.
That's a great, great exercise.
Yeah.
And in fact, I like that better than the one that I grew up hearing about, you know, what do you want your gravestone to say? And I mulled that, and about probably 15 years ago, I decided I knew the four words. There are only four words that I want on my gravestone, and there are four words that I want people to remember me by. And it has guided my work ever since. And those four words are, she helped me grow.
How about, I got a great one for my gravestone. You ready for this one? Yeah. Told you so.
I'm not sure, but go ahead.
No, I said, told you so.
Ah, told you so.
Yes.
Kind of shapes your work too, doesn't it?
Absolutely. All right. We're just about out of time. Website we can find you at?
www.executiveadvisorllc.com.
And can we get the book there?
Absolutely. How to Grow a Backbone, 10 Strategies for Gaining Power and Influence at Work. And coming soon, the first in the Backbone Guide series of Beauty and Substance, a Backbone Guide for Women. I'll keep you posted.
By the way, I'm going to peek at it even though I'm not a woman.
Oh, please do.
Okay.
That's wonderful.
Okay. Good night. See you next week.
Thanks, Michael Ray.
Bye-bye. Good night.
Bye-bye.
And the promise to be near each time you call. And the only heart I own for you and you alone. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime. And a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall. And a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. Oh, that's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're
good,
glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you look on from now and evermore. That's all. That's all.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Linda Malick with us is an award-winning writer, a columnist, and a journalist who has done extensive research on physicians and healthcare outcomes. And after being diagnosed with fibromyalgia 10 years ago, along with Dr. Patrick Rhodes, she is the author of What Your Doctor Doesn't Know About Fibromyalgia. Rhodes practiced pain medicine and physical medicine and rehabilitation in Modesto, California. And our guest, Linda, is a seasoned talk show guest who's appeared on NPR in Sacramento, Lisa, and is a guest on The Bruce Sessions Show and many, many other programs. Linda, hi, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you very much for giving me an audience to talk about chronic pain and to talk about the mismanagement of it from physicians. And this is something that really concerns me even more than fibromyalgia. It's until I got this disease, I did not know that doctors didn't keep up on recent research.
Interesting point. Now, let's lay a base of what we're talking about first. Fibromyalgia, let's talk about what it is first, and then we can work our way up from there. How about that? So define it.
Okay. Fibromyalgia has been around for about 40 years, and no one knows exactly what causes it. The symptoms of it include chronic pain, a kind of spaciness where you can't think straight, sleeping problems, bladder and bowel problems, and it's a cluster of symptoms that they have not, at first didn't, they thought were psychosomatic. And it took quite a while before doctors began to realize that it wasn't all in people's heads. Most likely to affect women, and also women in midlife or in menopause. So that had a lot to do with the fact that it was considered to be a psychiatric disorder.
Okay, now when we're dealing with it, with doctors in particular, you go to a doctor, you would say, I've got this problem, I got that symptom, I've got this symptom, and then the misdiagnosis can be obviously a problem for everybody. You're taking medication, you're doing this, you're doing that, and yet at the same time, nothing seems to happen. Where was the trigger for you to realize that you've got a problem, but nobody seems to have the answer? They're not asking the right questions.
Good question, because I was still working as the editor of the Paradise Post. I woke up one morning and I hurt everywhere in my body. Unlike what doctors say, I wasn't depressed. I had just come back from vacation. I bought my own house. I had a brand new car. I had a good social life. I had every reason to be happy, and I hurt everywhere. And I went to consult with several different doctors, including a physiatrist who is a muscle specialist. And the doctor told me it was in my head, that subconsciously I had to hate my job, and that was what was really causing it. And I would cry all the way home. I wanted to be a writer from the time I was a little girl. So I would cry all the way home because I was afraid I was going to lose my job, and I had a doctor who was telling me that I hated it. It didn't make sense at all, and I was able to find other doctors. You have to sometimes, I think you, on the average, you consult 4 doctors before you get the right diagnosis.
Now, by the way, what, quote unquote, what is the right diagnosis? What is it that they look for the right doctor and be able to connect with to say, this is what it is? And let me take that question one step farther. Then the fix for it.
The what for it? I'm sorry.
Fix. The fix.
Oh, sure. The fix for it. Okay, yeah. The right diagnosis is fibromyalgia. It's not that it's, you're not having emotional problems. And most doctors, the first thing they reach for is antidepressants because, as I said, they're still somewhat biased, and they think if you feel better emotionally, you'll feel better physically. And I had terrible times with antidepressants. And these are the drug du jour, the drug of the day for doctors, as opposed to giving you painkillers like oxycodone or morphine. Now, oxycodone and morphine have been around a long time, and we know the side effects of them. And they're also very inexpensive. But doctors are really, really hyped up with antidepressants these days. They believe that these are the cure for everything. And they have been, so many people are taking antidepressants these days that they don't want you to flush your pills down the toilet because they're in the water supply. This is really scary stuff.
Sure.
No, I don't want to sound like I'm one of these people who thinks I see aliens. This has all been bad, of course. But, they are the most popular antidepressants right now. If you ask your friends, you'll find, if you don't find a majority that have at least been recommended to take antidepressants, I would be really surprised.
Okay, now let's talk about this for a moment. Let me take this backwards here with fibromyalgia. Is it genetic? Is it chemical? Is it, where does it start from? Where does the
fibromyalgia? No one exactly knows what causes it or what cures it.
Okay.
Any more than they do Gulf War syndrome or chronic fatigue syndrome. And they're all in the same kind of, they're all in the same little group here. And no one knows right now what causes it or what will cure it. What was your question again?
Well, basically, the question was, where did it come from? And you're just answering it that nobody really knows what it is. So it's not a chemical imbalance. There's got to be a disconnect someplace because obviously the body, the immune system is set up. So if there is pain, it takes care of it. Unless there's somewhere there's a disconnect physiologically. Somehow that immune system is not working and you end up in pain. So there's got to be a something that they find. Let me ask it this way. What did they give you when they finally found out it was fibromyalgia? What did you take to feel better?
Well, they gave me antidepressants, and they made me feel better for about 6 weeks, and then they stopped working. And right now I take oxycodone, which is the most effective pain reliever, and it's very stigmatized. I mean, a lot of people consider that. I have withdrawn from it several times when I've gone into remission, and then since I'm not a drug addict, it hasn't caused me any problems. Withdrawing from antidepressants, though, has caused me a lot of problems. It makes me really ill. But back to your question about what do you think they caused, the last 2 years there's been some kind of exciting research that saying that it may be a retrovirus. Just like they used to say ulcers were in people's heads, and then they found out that it was really a virus or a bacteria, I'm not sure which in that case. But right now, the big studies, just in the last 2 years, and my doctor didn't know about this, so I told her, were that it's a retrovirus like AIDS, but it's not as deadly. But both Gulf War syndrome, chronic fatigue syndrome, and fibromyalgia are all in this thing. It is the same retrovirus, and it just affects people differently. It makes you ache all over and feel like you have the flu all the time. It also, like you said, the immune system is the big thing, because I have the flu 12 times a year, and I get everything from yeast infections, sores in my mouth, you name it, I get it. So this makes the most sense to me, and when I read it, I was like, ah, something I can buy, something that sounds like it makes sense. But they're still doing the primary research on it, and that is, you know, that will take several years before they can verify it and before they can come up with drugs that would control it. But it's something to look forward to if you have fibromyalgia.
Yeah, now realistically, what we're really dealing with, what I'm hearing you say, Linda, they're treating the symptoms, and what they're doing is band-aiding it because they don't truly have an answer for what the primary cause of this thing is. They don't even know what it is. They know what you feel like once you get it, but that's where it stops.
Yeah, this is true. However, it is one of the top five most painful diseases that we know of, up there with like shingles and rheumatoid arthritis. So sometimes a Band-Aid is really, really welcomed. Let me say that. And that's all we really do have right now. There is no cure. And occasionally you run into people who say, oh, I did acupuncture. I sent for multivitamins. And that's why I wanted everybody to read this book, because I did too. I spent so much money on all these various remedies until I came to the conclusion there are no remedies. The best thing you can do is keep yourself in the best possible physical health that you can. Eat well, sleep well, exercise as much as you can, lead a stressful life, which in today's society is hard to do. But there is not really a cure out there. There are treatments, but there is no cure. And spending a fortune on multivitamins is not gonna do it.
Well, no, I hear you loud and clear. We're starting to run out of time now. Do you have a website where we can find you at?
Oh, definitely. I have several websites. There's one allaboutfibro.com, and I also have a webpage at Amazon where my book is, and you can order a copy of my book. And also it's carried at Barnes & Noble's. And if you have questions, please email me. You can email me at Linda Meilink at AOL.com, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have. I also would be interested in any experiences that you have, because I hope to write another book about doctors and treating pain medicine.
By the way, wonderful. And thank you so much for joining us tonight. I've appreciated your time.
Thank you very much for helping me to get the word out on this.
Take care, and good night.
Good night.
Such as Mexico, Sweden, Hawaii, Japan, and Capri. There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases, pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there when there are so many fabulous faraway places to see? Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray, and Vancouver native Shelley Hallmark with us draws upon her own life experience and her journey to self-discovery to inspire and to motivate others. The book is Finding the Balance. That's her first book. Let us say, Shelley, hi, welcome to the show.
you.
Thank you.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. I want to read the first paragraph of your press release because I think that in and of itself will lay a great base of what we're going to talk about. It's called How to Deal with Energy Vampires. You know, there are certain people in your life that would just suck the life right out of you by thrusting their negativity on everyone around them. And according to Shelley, you have the power to stop these vampires in their tracks without running for the garlic or breaking out across. Now, by the way, I really believe in my heart of hearts there are, we used to call them psych suckers. They do the same thing. They just draw all of the stuff out of you. And most people, Shelley, they don't have the defense and they don't know what to do to stop it. Where was your turnaround time where you said, enough, and this is how I'm going to fix it?
I think I got to a point in my life that I had so many different people in my life that were basically the energy vampires. And it became overwhelming. And I found that, I thought, is it just me that's experiencing these? And I found through talking with others, like my friends and coworkers, and everyone was kind of experiencing the same events and asking the same questions. And I just got to a point that I was so overwhelmed and just depleted and drained from all of these energy vampires that were basically, you know, taking my happiness and just kind of draining it.
You know, when you really come down to it, I love the analogy because, you know, a vampire, quote unquote, sucks the blood out of you. But there are people out there that will suck the life energy out of you. And if you don't know what to do, if you don't know how to shield to protect yourself, that there's a lot of stress and problems that can occur from that.
Oh, yes, yes. And stress is probably, it's the most significant effect that it can have on us. I mean, it affects us in so many different ways. For every person, it's different. But stress on your body is just the worst thing. It's not stronger than, you know, some of the harder illnesses, but definitely right up there.
Now, there's got to be something to block them. And when I say something to block them, firstly, you have to become aware that they do exist. And then the second thing, you have to recognize them. Because if you don't recognize them, you're at their mercy and it's going to happen. And that's a lot of power for them to do what they do. Now, the idea here is you got to have something to be able to get it stopped. So what do? You got a shield or something that can cause them not to have the effect on you that they have.
The way that I found to at least identify it initially was that the way it would make me feel. I would usually start to feel, I don't know, just kind of not necessarily insecure, but just drained and tired and just overwhelmed with the idea of having to kind of basically fight off the negative aura that they project. And that was my first indication of when I would be, because a lot of times what people end up kind of ignoring or not realizing that they're in the presence of someone who is just kind of overwhelming as a personality and a lot stronger.
Sure.
So I would find that I would, you know, once I start to feel that way, then I would recognize that as being my first indication. And, of course, then my next reaction was usually to try and deflect it a bit, as in try and introduce some positive light into the conversation. And a lot of times, you know, most people with negative opinions, they don't really want to, they're not welcoming positive energy. So that's another indication that, you know, it's time to kind of put up a wall, not necessarily to just, you know, ignore them, but just kind of to protect yourself, knowing that that's what type of person is around you. And I find that a lot of times when I would talk about something more positive, the more positive I became, the more they would either feel uncomfortable or they would tend to back off.
Well, yeah, there was no effect on you.
Exactly. And the negativity just, it can't really survive in the positive light. It just kind of shrinks away, kind of like the vampire with the light in the daytime.
Sure. And you also get the strength within yourself once you begin, and recognize is a very important word here, when you begin to recognize, you know, the word empowerment seems to be thrown around a lot, But it's so true, because if you empower yourself, what that really means is you're giving yourself the strength to handle what it is that, comes at you, and you're responsible for the outcome because now you're in control of it. So
exactly.
To let yourself know what that is, there are certain steps you develop. So how do we begin? What's that first step when we put our foot on that path of self-empowerment?
The first step would be initially recognizing it. And then I think the part that is empowering is when you start to realize you have the ability to control, you know, where the conversations are going and how much you allow them to affect or impact you personally. And that's the first initial step. And the more you do that, the more empowered you become. And it's kind of, you become almost like an impenetrable force, in that after a while, it becomes a default way of handling it. And no matter what anyone does to kind of, you know, bring negativity to you, they just can't break through that.
So basically what you've done is you've shored yourself up. You've created this quote-unquote shield around you. When you've recognized it, you've done stuff to dilute their effect on you. And once you do that, all of a sudden life's a little better, because they don't want to waste time with you. They're not affecting you the way they want to.
Exactly. They're not getting the same reactions that they normally get from others who are not, I wouldn't say not strong enough, but just they don't have those boundaries in place. So they're unable to affect you in a more powerful way that they're used to. And it makes them become maybe not insecure, but feel a little bit less, you know, effective.
Yeah, and really I think a lot of these people who do what they do, the vampire types, I don't even know if they know they're doing it intentionally. And I think that makes it even worse.
Yes. And then there's also, and I mean, there's some people who just, I wouldn't say they thrive on draining others' energy. I think they thrive on the drama of it. They get kind of, you know, it's the same as being addicted to any sort of, a computer or anything like that. And
sure.
They just kind of, they thrive on that drama, and it becomes exciting, and they seek that out.
Now, by the way, once you got a hold of this and you started feeling better and you protected yourself against this, what was life like? What was the difference in how you felt when you got up, you went to work, you did whatever you do? What was the difference in the way you felt about it?
Oh, it was significant. I felt more empowered and stronger and just overall happier all the time. Like I said, almost like an impenetrable force, in that no one can take away my happiness. I'm going to enjoy my day. I'm going to enjoy everything I do. And it's just, it's so much, empowerment is so, it's exhilarating.
Well, Shelley, a lot of this is learned behavior. We learn to be at the mercy of people. So if you can learn something, you can unlearn, and then also you can relearn. And I think that's what the book is about. It's a relearning process, and it's really stepping into, standing in front of the mirror. You're reading the book, but you're also standing in front of a mirror, and you're getting to see who and why you, how you've been, and it'll also give you the choice of, if you don't want to be that way anymore, you don't have to be. And I think that's really the key.
Yes.
Did you know you had choice way back when? Probably not.
I think I always did know I had choice. It's more like I was always trying to show people the more happier way of life, in that the people who were feeling negative, I thought it was just because of other circumstances, like just unhappy work circumstances, unhappy life circumstances, things like that, that I felt was kind of, maybe that's what's bringing them down. And then, but I found later that, you know, you can't, it's the same as you can't, you know, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make it drink.
Absolutely.
If someone wants to embrace the negative, then there's no matter what you do, you can't help them to embrace positive. It's something that they have to choose.
Now, by the way, when you do this, and when you went through it yourself, and you went through the transition yourself, What about the people around you, the people that weren't the vampires? Did they begin to change too? Did you look at people differently, and those people who really deserved the attention got more? Did you go through something like that?
Yes, definitely. And I found that my relationships with those people were so much, they were way more pleasant. They were just, you know, the exchanges were fantastic, and that, you know, we almost inspired each other, you know, in a perpetual cycle. And I found that my daily living and with, you know, the people, like, say, it's exactly the same as I read at one time. I believe it's Wayne Dyer who said it. When you change the way you look at things, the things you look at change. And I've always remembered that and thought that was a great quote, because it's exactly true. I lived that one.
And by the way, you live around, to say it a different way, you live around the same people through the same circumstances, but the outcome is totally different. And I think the key word here, and with most things, it's got to be awareness. And Shelley, that's what it really brings it down to. If you're not aware of it, you don't recognize it, you're at the mercy of it. Once you become aware of it and you change your mindset, you look at it differently, then all of a sudden things completely change. Everything can be the same, but it's the outcome that's different.
Yes, yes, definitely.
Okay, I read the book, I pick it up page by page, cover to cover. What do I, Michael Ray, get out of the book? What's my takeaway? What do I have that I did not have before I read the book?
I would say that I hope that people realize that they do have the options. You know, they have the options to change whatever situation they're in to their liking. You know, I don't want a lot of people think that when they hit a certain point in their life, mostly age, they kind of put a ceiling on themselves, and they, you know, sometimes people stop trying, or they think, oh, I can't do that now. I'm not, you know, I'm you know, too old to do that, and it's crazy. People should never stop trying to achieve what they want, and that's what I want to do, is inspire them to realize that they do have options.
And by the way, that's really the key. Most people don't know or don't realize that they have options, they have other choices. You might feel it way down deep, but if there's not some kind of a practical guideline, some kind of a trail to follow, quote unquote, that says here's how to do it step by step, I'll hold your hand, most people get stuck in that lifestyle that you're talking about, that are at the mercy of the vampires and really don't feel good, and they come to the end, they get older, and they don't want to, it's too late, quote unquote, in their minds. And it's a life that's been wasted, and it doesn't have to be wasted. We live in a society today that there's, I hate to say this, but there's more vampires than not out there. And we have to be very careful about it. We have to arm ourselves against it.
Oh, yes, definitely. Definitely. And I just, the one thing especially is about the, I mean, you can change your life around so quickly. I mean, it can change at the drop of a hat, just from getting in a car accident that's completely changed your life altogether. And so, I mean, if it can change that quickly from something like that, then certainly anyone who has the options, you know, we just restrict ourselves by thinking we don't have options. And I just want everyone to know that they always do, and they should always keep trying, they want.
You bring up a valuable point. Let me say it in a different way. If you knew that tonight at midnight you were going to die, how different your life would be. The things that are bothering you now wouldn't bother you anymore, and
exactly,
you would live completely different for that amount of time. If you want to sit and get scared, well, then go do that. But whatever the case may be, all of those things that we worry about that change our life, that cause us to go down these roads that are not the best and the most productive for us, they don't matter anymore. They drift away. And if more people would live their life as if tomorrow didn't exist, if you lived it right now, but this moment, man, what a change there would be.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And I see a lot of that everywhere. A lot of people who I had thought were kind of in the negative zone, and I see a lot of them progressing out of it. Not everyone, but some of them.
No,
and
sure.
It's you know, it's positive to see, and it's actually exciting as well, because I think that's good. I mean, sometimes, you know, you accidentally or, you know, judge someone, which we shouldn't be judging anyone. But,
yeah, we do, though.
I mean, you do kind of get this idea in your head of how someone is, and then they surprise you. And I like those surprises. I think it's great when I see someone come out of that darkness to embrace a little bit, something a little bit more positive.
No question about it. Now, let me ask you this. We're starting to run out of time. Is there a website we can find you at?
Yes. I have my own author website. It is www.shellyhallmark.com.
And that's H-A-L-L-M-A-R-K, shellyhallmark.com. Now, can we buy the book on the website?
Yes, it's available on the website. It's also available through Amazon and Chapters and Barnes & Noble, pretty much everywhere. And, of course, my publisher, Balboa Press.
Wonderful. And by the way, thank you so much for joining us tonight. I've appreciated your time, and the message is really strong, and everybody should buy that book.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate you having me on.
Take care. Good night.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Up in your brain that's ringing,
making a crazy ding-dong.
And if this band don't desert us,
then there's nothing in the world can hurt us, long as we're singing our song.
Give me trumpets, legato.
Put some saxes with them.
Strings, pizzicato.
Add some rhythm. As long as we're singing, then the world's all right and everything's swinging. Long as we're singing now, long as we're singing now, long as we're singing.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and thank you for listening. Tell all your friends about this show. That's the way we grow. And I'll tell you what, that's what you truly call networking. And that, my friends, is a wrap.